This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with a Rabbit and Alex von Goldstein. We're going to be discussing retrofuturism. Great having you guys back on the show.
Hey, guys.
Aloha.
Basically, what a retrofuturism is how the past saw the future. And people have always been fascinated by the future. It's interesting to see how far back it's been. I'm sure people had fantasies of the future going way back to ancient times in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance era, but retrofuturism, the eras we're mostly going to be talking about, is mostly the 20th century and a little bit before that, when that's sort of an era when the 20th century where people were going through this rapid change and progress. So people were very fascinated by what the future would bring them and the sort of visions that they had of the future. And there's a lot of films, different futurist films, science fiction novels, artistic illustrations that have been done throughout history, and we're going to be discussing that. What is unique about retrofuturism is that it's something that exists in fantasy. There is this kind of debate about the present versus the past, and some people fetishize the past and say that we need to go back and recreate the past. And there's people who talk about present and saying that things are improving. And what is remarkable about retrofuturism is that it's, as I said, it's pure fantasy, and it's something that doesn't really exist in fruition. But the question is retrofuturism pure fantasy, or is it a blueprint for the future and something that we can draw inspiration from? And that's going to be kind of the overall theme of the show. Alex or Rabbit, if you guys want to add to that.
Yeah, well, I think that part of retrofuturism isn't so much trying to recreate the past, but it's a sense that, like, almost like navigating through time in a way. It's like we branched off in one direction, and then you're trying to get back to where these other branches are going,
so
by exploring all of these
kind
other
of
ideas.
Like an alternative universe, to use sort of a sci-fi lingo.
Yeah, exactly, because there's when you go back and you see that we could have gone in a lot of different directions. So it's not like I want to go back to live in the past, but it's like I'm trying to change direction, and there can be some things back there that give us a pathways to other futures that could be.
Well, in a lot of ways, I feel that retrofuturism, at least studying it, we're looking at the way that people in the 20th century imagined the 20th century, 21st century, how people in the 20th century thought the 21st century would be. And the interesting thing now is that we've sort of moved into this post-future space where, you know, I mean, at least in the 90s, I could remember people saying, well, by when we get to the year 2000, when we get to the year 2000. And now in conversations, you don't really hear these benchmark dates.
I remember when the millennial happened, and I was 14 at the time, but there was a lot of excitement about the future. Even then, and that's fairly recently, you don't really see that as much today. People kind of either accept that we're in the future, or people are pessimistic. And then 2000 was kind of the tail end of the 90s tech boom. Then after that, 9/11 happened, and then the economy crashed.
And then Iraq, you know. And
yeah, well, those things, you know, in themselves were kind of like apocalyptic events, you know, that could have been, depicted as part of the future. I think that a lot of those films and whatnot about the future, but like, we're really not so much about what people thought the future would be like, but they were just simply vessels to give commentary on things that were in the present. It allowed them to discuss certain issues by putting them in this kind of futuristic context that really they were talking about. I mean, Planet of the Apes is a great example of that. Like, it wasn't necessarily that they thought that the future was going to be this Planet of Apes. It was just kind of like they wanted to make a commentary on certain social issues, and they used that as a sort of backdrop for it, so they could get away with it and put it make it seem less offensive because you're putting it in this science fiction context.
Well, that's an interesting film to bring up, because that film is like a post-apocalyptic or post-collapse film. And, you know, that's definitely a huge genre. You have, you know, the Mad Max films. What is that one movie that Rudy Wurlitzer wrote? It's like it's a guy and girl walking around in this post-apocalyptic wasteland. You know that one?
No, there's A Boy and His Dog. There's that one.
Yeah. It's sort of like I can look it up, but it's like of the same era. But I feel like that's in Zardoz. I think that's in Logan's Run, where you have, you know, future films like, you know, I don't know, the Star Trek movies. But on the other side of it, there's films that produce sort of like a dark future.
Yeah, and I think that varies by era in terms of the present time, which we've talked about before. As when you have the future films of like the 50s and the early 60s, a lot of them were very like hopeful and optimistic about the future, like vast space colonization. And then the 70s were kind of like more like abstract dystopian. And then when you get to the 80s, future films like you know, Saturn 3 and Android and some of these other ones, like the future was Alien, like the future was kind of bleak, and it was like just the whole like setting was just so much darker, like Blade Runner. So you had those were like, I think, kind of reflections of the different periods of time in the present of those people.
The post-apocalyptic movie I was talking about was Glenn and Randa, and Wurlitzer wrote it, and Jim McBride directed, who did the remake of Godard's Breathless in 83 with Richard Gere. Have you guys seen Glenn and Randa?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay, I haven't seen it yet. That one's been on my list, but that's a 1971 post-apocalyptic film. So, I mean, if you look then, there was a lot of, you know, conflict going on in the Vietnam War, Nixon's re-election. I mean, the 72 election was a really, there was a lot of chaos going on in the culture then. So, yeah, I think you're right, Rabbit, that the view of the future is definitely an allegory for how people feel about the present moment.
Right, and also another thing about all of those post-apocalyptic movies of that time is, you know, I'm a little bit older than you guys, so like even when I was a kid in the early 80s, like it was like a given that like every kid just thought there was going to be a nuclear war by like the 1990s. Like we still had like fallout shelters and stuff in school where we would do drills and stuff. Even in the early 80s, I remember being just being convinced that like even when I was that the world was going to end in like 1992 or something like that. That was pretty common back then. So in the 60s and 70s, that's why you had so much of this like post-apocalyptic stuff, because everyone was pretty much sure that the U.S. and Soviet Union would have a nuclear war at some point.
You know what's funny is I thought the world was going to end growing up as well. You know, we had this whole like 1999 prophecy and the Nostradamus.
Oh, yeah.
And Y2K. You know, and then 9/11 started. You know, 9/11 happened, and there was this whole threat of terrorism, and this whole 2012 Mayan apocalypse. So, I mean, I'm sure Robert, you can relate to that. That even, you know, for us who are, I guess, like a generation younger than you, Rabbit, we had similar fears of an apocalypse.
Rabbit, when were you born? Alex was born in '89. I was born in '85.
Yeah, I was born in '78. So I'm like Gen X, kind of mid to late Gen X, So, but I mean, I can remember as far back as like 1982, and like 84, pretty prominent. Like,
it was interesting. As far and as with memory. Me, I would say, the earliest year I remember probably like if I had to guess, I'd say 89.
89 was about the earliest year you could remember.
Yeah, probably basically. What about you, Alex?
I mean, I can remember seeing George H.W. Bush on TV. So that was before, that was like, the, you know, before 93. I mean, yeah, maybe 92 I can remember, being like 3 years old, towards the end of 92.
I think with the whole future film thing, I think we could probably devote a whole other show to that topic.
Yeah, we probably can, because there is some stuff that I would want to get into as far as films that were like early, like precursors to neo-reaction thought, things like that, and different competing ideologies that we're in now that are basically mirrored by the themes of these different films.
I think the first major future film was the film from the 1920s, Metropolis. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I watched it in film class years ago. I barely remember it, though. I probably haven't seen it since, like, the late 90s.
Wasn't it influenced by Italian futurism?
You can totally tell by the aesthetic is actually, the art is totally Italian futurist style. It's same with, like, some other stuff in that same era, like the old posters for, like, the World's Fair and things like that around that time period.
Well, that was the Art Deco genre in architecture. That was one of the first major sort of futuristic-looking movements. Best to kind of describe the Deco style as a perfect combination of tradition and futurism. You look at a lot of these Art Deco structures in, like, New York. You have the Empire State Building, the Chrysler Building, the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. They're very futuristic and impressive, but at the same time, they also have a kind of old world charm to them. They don't have that, like, plastic feel or synthetic feel that a lot of newer stuff has. So I think out of all architectural genres, that era, the Art Deco era, best kind of combines futurism and tradition.
Yeah, I would agree.
Rabbit and I interviewed Thomas Rinaldi from he has a blog in New York, New York Neon. And it's interesting is I read a review of his book, and someone said, this is basically how the past saw the future. And you see that a lot also on, like, neon signage is used a lot of these different future films, from Metropolis in the 20s to a lot of the 80s films like Blade Runner. And it's also used in the sort of, like, 80s nostalgic style, like a lot of those vaporwave illustrations.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That kind of leads right into the vaporwave stuff, which I don't know, like, I didn't realize until recently, like, how big this vaporwave stuff was, because I would always see it, and to me, I always just thought it was, like, basically, like, people making, like, early 90s style, like, video game art, you know, and things like that. I was just, and as someone who, like, was making music back then, it's kind of funny to see some of those old, like, I had a lot of those old keyboards, which at the time, like, I didn't even appreciate. I thought, like, oh, man, these have, like, the most, like, garbage, like, kind of, like, video game MIDI sounds, you know? Like, I wish I could get, like, some real synth action. But now you see, like, a lot of that almost kind of, like, mellow Leisure Suit Larry kind of music is kind of refound a genre.
Oh, you're talking about kind of like the elevator music, like a Macintosh Plus.
Yeah, exactly. Because a lot of the vaporwave aesthetic, it reminds me of, like, kind of like video game like scenery from like Nintendo games like Rad Racer and F-Zero and things like that, but then it also incorporates this a music that's like from like a mix of like video game music and like a mellow like elevator music from like a like late 80s erotic thriller movies or something like that. That's a kind of it's a combination that I see when I
there's kind of two vaporwave genres. There's the one of like the kind of crude designs where you have like the Roman bus and just it's kind of collage like, and then you have the more sophisticated ones that feel kind of like these animations that feel kind of like a depiction of how maybe like the people in the 80s are the future, and they show like a DeLorean driving through like a futuristic city with all this, it's black with like all this neon, and there's also like a lot of Japanese influence. There's some different, there's like different styles. I think there's different, like within vaporwave there's different genres within that even.
Did you hear that James Ferraro album from 2012, Far Side Virtual? Do you know that record, Far Side Virtual, by James Ferraro?
No.
Nope.
Well, Ferraro is one of these, like, I think he's, like, from L.A. He's, like, a noise guy. I'm not sure if he was in this group, the Skaters, or not. But, you know, it's just sort of, like, this droning noise music. And then, and like he made a couple albums like that, and then he adapted himself into making this kind of like, yeah, he was in the Skaters, like a noise band, and then he adapted himself into making like this Windows 95 startup screen music in like 2012. And since then, he's gone to like making imitation hip hop music, and like
okay.
You know, not and not to kind of, you know, say this about myself, but I'm sort of like a hipster. Like this is so embarrassing. So, you know, was going to like, you know, noise shows around this time and hanging out with a lot of people that were really into this kind of droning stuff, and then I graduated college and I saw my friends were making like this Windows 95 type music, or going prefab, this British group Prefab Sprout, sort of going back to this like Steely Dan, like super technical pop music kind of stuff, synthetic technical pop music. And then I've seen this divergence where some people sort of go into more hip hop oriented fields, and some people go into like more house and techno. Like, people have rejected rock music outright. And a lot of these people that are into techno, they read, like, you know, I don't know, Deleuze and, like, this sort of, like, post-structuralist, post-modern kind of philosophy. But part of me sort of thinks that there's something inherently Eurocentric about techno and about drone music. And part of that, I feel like, is people searching for some kind of origin, you know, like going through all this deconstructionalist literature, like what is the meaning of life, what is the meaning of life, and like listening to this techno music and feeling something but not really being able to tell what that is. And to me, I sort of think that's something that's kind of inherently European.
Yeah, I think like Steve Saylor wrote an article when he was talking about EDM as being like a sort of a music for like white Europeans. It was kind of it like evolving into that. I mean, there a lot of people would take issue with that because there are a lot of different, you know, non-white artists in that,
you know,
genre.
Detroit techno is a total black invention.
But like, but at the same time, I think I know what you mean. Because for me, like, I can also see that there's like going to South by Southwest, like I used to go to that every year for several years, and I noticed that the last time that I went a few years ago, it was a lot less like rock oriented, and it was more like these the more popular events were like these DJ dudes, and it was all like techno and dance music associated, and like the new rave stuff. Whereas kind of like when I was in the early 90s, I remember like more of the first wave of that stuff, you know, with like Fresh Jive Clothing and all that kind of stuff, which is like...
This kind of ties in with retro futurism, because I think the 80s music style, I mean, a lot of people today kind of make fun of it as 80s music for being cheesy, but in some ways it was very kind of a futuristic in its thinking and style. And then in the early 90s, we had grunge, and then you had hip hop became dominant in the 90s. And
say in the early 90s, so you had like the rave culture, which I remember in 1992, around 1992, 1993, that was like, I remember being like 15, and just the way that people dressed and stuff, that was like the first time that I ever thought like, wow, like this stuff really looks like, these people really look futuristic. So, I mean, we wore like gigantic, like, orange pants and things like, it was totally like way out, like so like much different than like it seemed like we were living in the future. I remember being like really disappointed because like that whole scene was over with in like a year or two, and then it just morphed into came lumped in with like you know, like more like just hip hop and punk and stuff. And
it went mainstream.
People just started dressing more. People just started dressing more like normally, and I was kind of disappointed by that because I thought we were like going into the future, but then it was just like a quick fad that died out right away, and then it was like, oh, we're going back to just looking like hip, like whatever the mid 90s went into was like more of like the alternative kind of and hip hop and all that stuff.
There was a genre of music that became really popular like in the early 2010s, and it's called like a synth wave or new retro wave, and you have these like bands out of Canada, like Electric Youth and FM Attack. And they kind of seek to create this, kind of recreate that sound of a mid-80s music. Are you familiar with that genre?
A little bit.
Electric Youth, they made the music for Drive, right? With that French group College?
Yes.
And it's
Robots,
funny.
Robots, yeah. With Ray Guns is another one. Go ahead.
It's funny because College... They have a an album, I think it's called Heritage, and you know, it's like all this sort of like early 80s Vangelis sort of sounding stuff, and it's, you know, it's like this lone man walking on a mountain with clouds behind him, and it just says Heritage above him, so I think that's sort of funny.
Yeah, there's also, I think, Robots with Ray Guns is another one of those bands that recreates the 80s aesthetic. They do a really good job of it, too. I don't even think they're that huge of a band, but pretty impressed.
In some ways, I think some of those bands, they've captured the 80s sound, but they've made it a little more sophisticated in some regards. I know, Rabbit, you were telling me you grew up in the 80s, but do you see 80s music as cheesy, or do you see it more as a futurist oriented?
I can see the future aspect of it. I think what's one of the reasons why that it's getting big is because the retro interest in it is because it was like right around the time that these people were born, or right before that. So as someone who like grew up in the 80s, like I have more of a like a fascination with like these stuff from the 60s, like mod and like 70s, you know, and all this kind of stuff, you know, because it was like the beatniks. It's like, because it's right before my time, so to speak. So it's like I'm really into that stuff. So I think some of these, a lot of these kids that may have been born like in the 90s or the late 80s are kind of nostalgic for the stuff that like maybe was in like the culture like when they were very young children or like right before that.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, even like watching a film like Drive, which is, you know, a movie, I think it's from 2010. I mean, it feels very modern, at the same time, there is this kind of Michael Mann, early 80s energy riding throughout the entire thing. And, you know, it's weird because I feel that, I don't know, maybe I'm just saying this because this is the time that I've existed in, but I feel like we've seen such an acceleration of trends. You know, almost like every 3 years, the trend of the youth changing drastically. I mean, maybe, has it always sort of been like that in Western culture, or since modernity? Or?
It has for the basically the second half of the 20th century. But I think what's happened is culture. I think the 90s was like the last era when people were doing something different. But what happened is the culture kind of stagnated. People are craving for something different, so they're taking stuff from the past and trying to reinvent it. But I think that's kind of how this whole theme of a retrofuturism comes in, because society as a whole has seen kind of culture stagnate, and people are craving something new, so we can't kind of continue down the same path. But at the same time, you're not going to just create an exact replica of us, and that's what is so like fascinating about this topic.
I think that another thing that's that has to do with it too is the internet allows for these things to develop much more quickly, and for all of these subcultures to materialize very easily into their own little group. Whereas in the 80s and 90s, you had basically these monocultures that were just dictated like throughout by the media, which is essentially all uniform, and you had a little like smaller subcultures and different genres and whatnot that would develop, but the communication wasn't advanced enough that they could spread so quickly and die out so quickly as they are now. You know, they're just like the stuff can literally become a thing like overnight, you know, and then people get bored with it and they move to the next thing because it all moves so quickly because of the internet. It's not because some guy is making like a zine, you know, and handing it out, and then over years and years, like finally it gains steam, you know.
It's instant and dies immediately.
And then you also have a cyberpunk, which ties in with what we were talking about. It's a kind of a cyberpunk movement is fascinated with like the 1980s futurist films and aesthetic. But what's interesting about, and they're fascinated with films like Blade Runner and science fiction writers like Isaac Asimov. But what also is interesting about that is it has a strong kind of connection with like both Silicon Valley techno-libertarians, but also the Dark Enlightenment.
I'm like William Gibson. So far, all right.
Well, I remember actually like reading, like in the early 90s, like this, like article in Time or one of some of these magazines, and it was like, "Are you a cyberpunk?" You know, and then it just like outlined the whole thing. And I remember thinking at the time, like me and my friends, like were kind of laughing about it because it was like. It was kind of like the mainstream news organization trying to like describe something that like nobody knew that we existed, like would have called themselves this sort of thing, you know, like a cyberpunk. You know, it was kind of like a publication trying to talk about some what the kids are up to.
The publication labeling the movement.
But with
yeah, exactly.
With all this,
like nobody I knew considered themselves like a cyberpunk, but I guess they would have fallen because they were like ravers and they drank smart drinks and they were into all of this futuristic kind of music and whatnot.
Just,
but
I
think Timothy Leary kind of reinvented himself as a cyberpunk in the 80s and 90s.
I was thinking, though, it's like, you know, these people, they would never call themselves cyberpunk. It's just what, like, media would refer to them as. And you saw the same thing happen with hipsters and swipples and social justice warriors. And isn't it funny that people who are on the alt-right just take that label? I mean, I guess it is a self-made label. But I think there's, like, this... What did Kierkegaard say about, like, once you name something, it no longer exists or something like that? I can try to pull up the Do you know that quote?
Nope.
But yeah, I mean, what do you guys think about that? Because it's like once something is labeled, yeah, it's like what Kierkegaard said basically is, if you name me, you negate me. By giving me a name, a label, you negate all the other things I could possibly be.
It puts you into an ideological box, and it prevents intellectual expansion.
Well, I think in the case of the alt-right, what happens is that it puts people in a box, and they're like, they don't necessarily want to be boxed in with some of the other people that are in there. So that's why they don't want to accept the label. Same thing with, you know, hipsters or some of that. But I feel like people who are part of hipster culture, like whether they know it, you know, but like when the cyberpunk thing was like, when I was a kid, it was like a totally alien term. It was like they just made it up for that article or something, and then it became a thing, something like that. The term hipster was used by the beatniks, that were a hipster, you know, hepcat and those kind of things were used back then. Like
cyberpunk is just a term, like I discovered it just via like online subcultures. But I'm sort of fascinated by sort of the aesthetics of these different things. And each one of these has their own sort of aesthetic image, including like a music, a fashion, culture, architecture. And this is kind of, I remember Rabin and I were talking on our Vegas show, like about like hypothetical, like fantasy casinos. But it'd be kind of interesting to have like retro futurism being a theme, like a steampunk one. You could start off with like a steampunk, and then like the whole sort of Metropolis Art Deco thing, and then you could go on to like cyberpunk. And out of all those, and then you obviously have the mid-century space age from the 50s and 60s, and then the 70s had their own futurist aesthetic. Rabin and Alex, out of all these retro-futurist movements, which one aesthetically and culturally appeals to you the most?
I mean, I would say, like, it's tough to say, because if there was one, like, you know, you get bored of any casino, like, pretty quickly, so it would be only for, I think that, like, a vaporwave themed casino would be pretty pretty rad, like a late 80s like video game aesthetic. But I also think like a Logan's Run type of set, like 70s futurist.
Do you think the vaporwave aesthetic really exists in architecture at all? I mean, the only thing I can think
of is maybe pictures.
Like, maybe like picture. I've seen pictures of like maybe some of the Asian cities. I guess you see it. Well, yeah, you see it in arcades, and even in some photographs of 80s shopping malls to some degree. But it's not really something that's been implemented.
Yeah. Well, I would say that like it kind of reminds me of the aesthetic of like maybe the types of dance clubs you would see in the late 80s with, you know, very like neon like interior and kind of stuff, like I guess like maybe like in Tron and some of this kind of stuff. And you would see you definitely like almost like architecture though that looks like it would be in like a video game from that era, like almost of that exact like kind of look. So it would be kind of almost a new thing, but I think you would get a feel for it by watching, I don't know, like kind of B-movie thrillers from maybe like 1987 to 91.
Even like Blade Runner kind of captures that feel, but I think that was filmed in like, I forget, it was either Tokyo or Hong Kong in the 80s.
Well, it's just Blade Runner though seems a little bit too dark for what I'm thinking. What I associate vaporwave with is a lot of like the colors, you know, like the weird color sky.
Magenta.
And, yeah, exactly. Like, so I think that the casino interior would have something like kind of how the casinos now, like Paris, have that artificial sky or something. It would just, the interior would be like an artificial, like a vaporwave kind of interior, like that, like a Rad Racer kind of look to it.
Is the whole vaporwave, is it like, I think it kind of started out more as like a meme culture, kind of similar to what Pepe is now.
It was music. I think vaporwave was a genre of music that was popular. You know, that Macintosh Plus album came out in 2012. And the James Ferraro album, Far Side Virtual, was the same. It was released the same year. That was Wire Magazine listed the Ferraro album as record of the year. But as that sort of aesthetic found its way onto Tumblr, I think over the last 2 years we sort of saw the cultural, you know, movement of vaporwave come into play with you know, the silo cup, that sort of the design that's on the cup, the wave.
Oh yes,
you know. But the funny thing is, what was that, Rabbit?
Oh. Yeah, I was just going to say, like, I watched it, like, a documentary on the history of vaporwave, like...
Oh, I saw that, yeah.
And, like, early on, it was kind of, like, this revival of, like, a mix of, like, video game music and, like, a, like mellow, like, 80s, like, jazz.
Elevator
kind
music.
Kind of like that. Yeah, exactly, like that elevator... like music, I associate it with like movies from that time period, like those like late night B movie thrillers, you know, and or like movies like It Takes Two and things that are just kind of like just so like 80s that they're practically forgotten. They didn't even like stand the test of time.
So with this whole sort of like, I talked about like the synth wave and the new retro wave music from the early 2010s that sort of captures the 80s. I also remember, like, in the late 90s, there was this music that tried to capture kind of the 60s, like, Britpop sound. I can't think of the name of a band off the top of my head, but I remember that.
Like Oasis?
Oh, yeah.
No, I can think of a lot of, like, Majestic was one, and even, like, Phantom Planet was one that was kind of in that vein. There was, like, the Strokes. And some of the, there were a lot of late 90s bands that had that, and it was like a big mod kind of revival during that.
Well,
that
was
era
sort of like the American wave. You had like this revival of, I don't know, kind of like weird nationalism in England in the mid 90s that sort of came at, sort of coincided with Tony Blair and the rise of New Labour. You know, like when Morrissey would wave the Union Jack, or Paul Gallagher would be playing a guitar with a Union Jack on it.
Huh.
And it's kind of funny because Tony Blair basically opened up the gates for, you know, London to become completely Islamic.
You brought up Islam, there actually is kind of a Islamic retrofuturism. Mecca, with all their oil money, is building like these giant like mosque skyscrapers. So that's, I guess you could call that Islamic retrofuturism.
That's kind of like archaeo. I would say that's like in the Guillaume Fay sense of archaeofuturism, that, you know, the past events just repeat themselves with our current technology. You know, I think Fay sees the migrant situation in Europe as the same thing as, you know, past invasions of the Moors in Europe. I know in his MPI speech from last year, he was like, this happened before. This happened 310. You know, he's going on about, you know, and that's the thing. History is cyclical. It repeats itself, and now it's repeating. We're seeing these sort of Middle Ages events just with our current technology and our current liberalism replacing our Christianity.
So with retrofuturism, is it sort of an aesthetic for a new political movement? I know political movements, whether it's communism fascism, the hippie movement of the 60s, kind of left counterculture, all these movements have their own aesthetics that, because you need an aesthetic, music, culture, architecture, to inspire people. Do you see retrofuturism as potentially being an aesthetic for a movement?
Richard Spencer is having vaporwave acts perform at the MPI conference in November.
Yeah, I think that that's important. I think that that's one thing a lot of these websites completely ignore. And that's one difference that you see between like left-wing websites and right-wing websites. If you look at right-wing political websites, they're all exclusively political, whereas left-wing sites will be largely cultural, but they'll insert the political into it. You know, like Rolling Stone and these other publications. They're cultural publications, but they're also politically. They insert the political in there. Whereas if you look at the popular right-wing websites, especially like the conservative, like basic bitch ones, you know, like National Review,
yeah,
Red State, and those ones, like they're focused. It's all just political
or even
articles.
A lot of the alt-right websites, like the alt-right websites, a lot of it is just critiquing culture. Like they write these movie reviews.
Right.
Well, Greg Johnson wrote a review of the New Order album, Music Complete, and kind of explained how he sort of was saying that he saw like a familiarity with that record. I mean, there's the first song on it, there's like an Enoch Powell quote in it. So I think that there is, I think that there's this weird thing you can do where you can take art and no matter what it is, you can make that art reflect your ideas.
I interviewed Colin Waddell about Bowie, and what he was saying in England back in the 70s and 80s, a lot of these pop culture figures or counterculture figures like David Bowie and New Order, they kind of flirted with fascist imagery, and part of the reason is because at the time the conservative establishment, Thatcher, sort of had a strong reverence for Winston Churchill. So it was a way to kind of be subversive and give the middle finger to the establishment.
Yeah, and I think that that's one thing that I've always tried to do in my writing, which is to some of these old things from the culture, even like 70s TV shows and things like that. Most people don't really explicitly think of those as being like a part of like white culture or white identity or whatnot, but I always insert them because it's kind of like a lot of them are so alien to what it is now that it's like, you know, all of this stuff from these eras or whatever that you used to like doesn't exist in like a non-white society. It's completely alien to anyone else. And when you look at it retroactively through that prism, you see that like even a lot of these old shows, of course, you know, some of them have a heavy Jewish influence, but when you watch a lot of these shows from like the 1970s or the 60s, like the Fugitive or things like that, Mission Impossible, like they're you know, they're from a specific type of culture. I think that in terms of the alt-right, though, you do see a lot of artistic things. Like Murdoch would be probably, in my mind, the best example of cultural art that's within part of the alt-right sphere. Because most people don't even think of that stuff as art, but I think of that as like a new kind of like vaporwave or something. It's almost like a new form of like pop art mixed with surrealism or something like that.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Not,
I mean,
a joke.
No, I don't think so. I think that there is something that really draws me into like Morak Hue's songs on YouTube or Uncuck the Right, who now goes by Walt Bismarck. The video, what was the We Didn't Start the Movement video with when Jared Taylor is playing saxophone wearing a Hawaiian shirt and sunglasses. Exactly. I mean, there's something that's really goofy and weird about people like Jared Taylor and even Richard Spencer and probably us at the same time. And
yeah, if we
can make
fun
public. Of each other. What was that?
Yeah.
But I think what I'm trying to put the direction of the show I'm pushing it in is putting a more show on culture, because as you were saying, like with Rolling Stones, they're a cultural magazine, but they put in political stuff. And I think the show is a unique opportunity to sort of carve out that niche.
Yeah, and I think that, like, the political stuff, a lot of it is just, it just isn't that interesting to me. Like, once you've written things that you want to say about it, I mean, you know, how many more, like, articles do you really need to read about, like, some migrants raped some people, you know, or something like that? Like, there's only so much of that is interesting if you're, like,
This kind of stuff, like reading the story, it's like despair porn. It gets people angry and depressed, but doesn't inspire people. I think aesthetics and culture is what inspires people.
And music.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's funny. I remember, you know, I was talking to a lot of friends of mine and just sort of like sharing old paintings and music and stuff like that, and people are, you know, really interested in that stuff, and they're not really exposed to it because our media kind of pretends that doesn't exist. So, you know, I'm doing that, and then as soon as people, you know, were like, oh, this guy's alt-right or whatever, this guy's alt-right, then all those things I was trying to show become like banned art. You know, it's almost like we do live under this weird emotional communism now.
Could you make a case that Trump kind of has a retro-futurist vaporwave appeal? I mean, Trump Tower itself has a retro-futurist aesthetic.
Well,
yeah, actually,
Richard Spencer
like,
said he's the Napoleon of the current year.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up because, you know, part of the appeal of Trump to me is that he is like an 80s figure that I remember from my childhood. You know, like I remember watching the scandals with like Marla Maples, and I remember like, you know, Trump, the game show and that kind of stuff. And just like the whole, like, I mean, he was like a figure even back then. Like, I mean, I think like I had like a Playboy magazine or something where from like 1991 where he was on the cover. And, so when part of it is like a nostalgia for like that period in time for me, like even though it was actually, you know, retroactively looking, it was the country was moving into some horrible directions behind the scenes. You know, like you had the amnesty in 1986, and you had the end of the Cold War interventionism all over the place, and the globalization, NAFTA. Like, I didn't really, you know, to me, I was just a kid, so I didn't really see all that, but Trump still represents a kind of like a vaporwave figure from that. He's from that era for me.
What do you think about the like aesthetic design of the Trump Tower?
I think that the design of it is like it does have that kind of look to it. It's kind of a gaudy or whatever, but Trump Tower is kind of like plain, if you ask me. I don't know. That's just my opinion.
There was another architect from the 70s and the 80s, John Portman. I showed you some of his stuff. And his stuff is kind of, a lot of the architectural critics hated his work because they saw it as being very kind of a corporate. But it's similar to Trump Tower in a sense because the outsides were very plain, but he had these just spectacular, like, futuristic atriums and these glass elevators. You saw some pictures of his work.
That's another kind of like I guess the interior like corporate look of the buildings from the 70s and 80s is something I kind of remember, that whole kind of like they had the kind of like an indoor shopping mall, like kind of like the building Nakatomi Plaza from Die Hard, you know, that kind of indoor like atrium kind of look to it.
I noticed when we were in Vegas also the Luxor, which was built, that was built in the 90s, but the Luxor has that kind of the atrium look too.
Yeah, this like, it reminds me when I was a kid and we used to like skateboard downtown and stuff. We would, you know, duck into these buildings and whatnot, and these corporate buildings. And I just always remembered the atrium, like an interior of these places. It's just like, it really stands out to me as being very, very 80s corporate. And you could see it in like movies from that era too. Like, I don't know, maybe like Secret of My Success and some of the other ones.
A lot of architectural critics, they hate that style because it's kind of closed off from the street level. Part of the reason they did that was, like, back then cities like New York had a lot more crime, so they were more insular. But there is something kind of mysterious about discovering something rather than seeing stuff right now, seeing, like, everything right on street level. With architecture, I guess one other genre is of retrofuturism is steampunk, which deals with the Victorian aesthetic. And a lot of that, there was like a lot of that is inspired by like science fiction novels like H.G. Wells and Jules Verne. And there's this whole kind of a LARPy movement of a steampunk people where they dress up like Sherlock Holmes and they have these like mechanical claws. And it's, but I'm sort of fascinated by that kind of architecture as well, because I remember when I visited London, I was really, I'm like a big fan of the sort of like Victorian era train stations. There's another building called the Bradbury Building in LA, which was featured in Blade Runner, which it has this big atrium and all this like wrought iron metalwork. But I'm also interested in the sort of the steampunk, more like their sort of architectural visions. Alex and Rabbit, are you familiar with the steampunk?
Yeah, I am. I've seen like on eBay people selling like props and stuff, and I even saw there's like this I think a website that sells like I think it sells like laser guns or something, and they even have like a steampunk looking one. As a variation, but I'm a big fan of some of the, Edgar Rice Burroughs, that kind of steampunk stuff, like at the, at the Earth's core and the land that time forgot, some of that. That's totally has a steampunk, not so much really a completely futuristic vibe, but a little bit. I like steampunk. It's not my preferred aesthetic, but I definitely see the appeal of it.
Seems like that movie Wild Wild West ruined steampunk.
Oh yeah.
Put a nail in its steampunk looking coffin.
You can buy tons of steampunk stuff on eBay. Like I just know that I was like looking for. I was looking for like some other kind of stuff, right? And all of the steampunk like crap just kept popping up into the searches, and I was like really bummed out. Is whatever I was looking for.
And I think out of all the like retrofuturism, I think what's significant about steampunk is it's sort of the oldest of all of them. Like the 80s stuff and 70s, like that's sort of in the lifetime people today, but steampunk is Victorian England's like a really long time ago. But with me, I'm just sort of fascinated with the architecture of a lot of these like train stations, and especially the ones in Europe, but even some of the ones in the United States. I know that place Rabbit and I went to in Vegas called the Wynn. That place is kind of inspired by a lot of those old, like a lot of Victorian era, like gardens and palaces and stuff, or a lot of the stuff from like Paris of the late 19th century. Did you kind of get that?
Yeah, it kind of like has like a like an Alice in Wonderland kind of look to it. You know, I don't know, maybe even actually what it really reminds me of is like Willy Wonka.
Oh yeah.
Actually, what it reminds me of, like that, the 70s.
Willy Wonka is kind of steampunk because it's basically taking like a old late 19th century factory and like making it really like advanced and futuristic.
Yeah, that reminds me that another big steampunk influence, I think, is the Final Fantasy games for Super Nintendo. Specifically, Final Fantasy VI has very kind of a steampunk a vibe to it. It's kind of like a with like the airships and the different kinds of machinery and stuff like that. It's totally a steampunk kind of game, which also it does relate to maybe some of the vaporwave, but definitely Final Fantasy VI stands out in my mind as a very sort of steampunk game.
And even some of the 80s, like 80s shopping malls have a kind of like a Victorian inspired aesthetics. You know, kind of know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, a little bit, but I never really thought about it.
We've covered a lot of topics about retro futurism, but out of all these, do you think each one ties in with a specific political ideology or culture? Do you think some would be more popular with, like, say, libertarians, some more with a leftist, some more with like a traditional conservatives?
Yeah, I think that cyberpunk, like you said, you know, kind of had a techno-libertarian angle to it, and then now is like a dark enlightenment type movement. I mean, that's because it's also attached to like an area, like Silicon Valley. I know that Anatoly Karlin told us that one of the areas with the biggest amount of Trump supporters in California was Silicon Valley. So.
Oh yeah, I think, well, not so much like the tech elites, the tech oligarchs that hate him, but the rank and file workers, a lot of them are angry about the H-1B, so I think he does have some support.
Well, I mean, they're also
even
high
like
IQ
Ron,
guys.
Yeah, Ron Unz, who we interviewed, is from the Silicon Valley.
I mean, I think there is something to people having an exceptionally high IQ and thinking in terms of, you know, a really solid time preference for the next 200 or so years. Yeah. You know.
I've been to the Silicon Valley. It doesn't really have a cyberpunk aesthetic.
Oh, I'm sure not. Maybe on the headphones of one or two of the guys walking around.
It pretty much looks like your stereotypical kind of, most of it like a suburban area with like office parks and shopping, like upscale shopping malls. The other trend I've seen on with shopping malls is there was this other thing where people have made kind of a outdoor shopping malls based on 19th century Americana or old European cities, like these outdoor malls. With retrofuturism, there's so much more like exciting stuff that could be done, like a vaporwave themed like place or a cyberpunk themed place. The thing is, people want do stuff to make a profit that's profitable, but there's not really a strong vision, and there's so many great ideas out there, but they're never implemented. They're rarely not always implemented.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that a lot of what you see now is that they're just like playing it safe to make a profit. They're not really doing it. I mean, you see that with movies, you know, they're just doing like remakes or just bland, you know, superhero stuff. It's all just like totally market research. And I think the same with these outdoor malls is they're not really doing anything interesting when they make these things. There's not any imagination that that goes into it. That at least that I see, they're just like, you know, the firms that they're hiring to like design these places or whatever, like they don't seem to have anything imaginative in mind or any kind of real vision. It's just like, you know, here's something safe that this company is going to, you know, going to build this, and they're not going to look at you like, what are you crazy? You know, like why would we want to build this like a vaporwave mall, you know, or something like that? It's just they don't take that kind of
they don't believe in the good life.
Well, there's this mall in LA called Century City, and it was built in the 1960s, and it had that kind of a 1960s futurist aesthetic. It was considered very futuristic when it was built back in the 60s, but they remodeled it, and now it looks like just like your generic kind of a, like a Westfield shopping mall.
Yeah, I haven't been there, but it's interesting that you bring that up, because what I think is a classic like 80s mall is the Galleria, you know, which just isn't there anymore, but that was in the San Fernando Valley, and that's like, if you watch
any the Glendale
movie,
one.
Like that's, yeah, if you watch any like classic 80s movie, you know, like Commando or even like, you know, Terminator 2, I think, but it's Valley Girl, I think it's in like so many different movies, but that has a very like kind of neon vaporwave kind of look to it. You know, it's a shame that that got torn down. They didn't value that.
There were like different, there's different malls in LA. I grew up in LA, and I grew up in the 90s, but I remember kind of the malls before they were renovated. So there was kind of one on the west side called like West Side Pavilion, which was built in the 80s, and it had more of a kind of a faux Parisian, like Victorian aesthetic with all these kind of like weird, like colorful, like pyramids. And it was stereotypically 80s. I think it was featured in like, it's featured in Tom Petty's Free Falling and in the film Clueless. And then there was a there's another mall, the Beverly Center, which also has been renovated, but it used to have that kind of a vaporwave aesthetic with like a lot of like neon and this cool like outdoor escalator. But people make fun of like 80s malls as being cheesy, but I think a lot of them are a lot more innovative than a lot of these newer malls. But as far as malls go, I think a lot of those 80s ones were a lot more innovative than the newer ones.
Yeah, I'm definitely a mall person. Like, I go to the mall all the time, which is kind of odd because I'm very, like, anti-capitalist. Like, why would I, like, enjoy the experience at the mall? But
it's interesting is you're like, kind of a commie, but aesthetically, your aesthetics are closer to capitalism.
Well, I mean, maybe we don't really have, like, a lot of anything else to choose from here. I mean, we live in the United States, but I actually do prefer a lot of those, like, there's, you know, like those East German buildings and art and whatnot.
I did see this image online. It was of a, like, socialist, I think it was from, may have been from East Germany, I forget, but it was like this futuristic socialist city dreamed in the 70s, but it actually looked really pretty cool.
The thing about the mall is that while you know, it is a bastion of capitalism and can be an awful place, when you go early on a weekday, there is something kind of transcendent about it. You know, there's sort of like quiet music and just clean marble floors, and it can be a strange enlightening experience.
Malls have kind of a decline with like the internet, people buying stuff online and spending more stuff online. I mean, even though it was like crass consumerism, at least people were actually going out instead of like staying home and being on their iPhone all day.
I live in New Jersey, so the mall rats haven't died at all.
But yeah, one thing, I've been to the Beverly Center many times, and I remember a lot of the kind of weird, like kind of like neon, like holdover stuff. Like it had been like remodeled even then, but there's still some.
They remodeled it about 10 years ago, and they're remodeling it again. We're out of time, so Alex or Rabbit, do you want to add like any other thing about a retrofuturism that we didn't get a chance to touch upon?
I think we covered it all.
Yeah, I think we got a lot of it. I mean, we could do probably another show about some of the topics, but I think we got. I think we covered
movie show.
Yeah, we covered a lot of ground. I think so. I'm good.
So, Alex von Goldstein and Rabbit, it's been a great show. We've covered a lot of interesting topics. Retrofuturism is a really fascinating topic and an interesting idea that I think can provide a lot of inspiration for people. Thanks, guys, for being on.
Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure, guys. Have a good one.
You too.
That's all we have for today's show, and take care. care and we'll be back with you next time.